Welcome to the A to Zidane of football, sponsored by Kooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Each week we take a letter from the alphabet and go through subjects, starting with that letter, stuff that's connected to the culture of the game. Then at the end of the show, we decide there's not enough contact in the game. VAR is useless and football was better in the 80s. Disagreeing with football was better in the 80s is Derby fan Blake Fellows. Hi, Blake.
Hi, Tim. Yes, back in my day.
Back in my day, yeah. You're here to stop me doing that. I've really thoroughly enjoyed myself just a few minutes ago watching you argue with a Leicester City fan on Twitter. Do you know what? He has a point. He has a point when he's saying they're the pride of the Midlands, because they're doing pretty well. They won the bloody league a few seasons ago and they've got a brand new 100 million pound training facility. Have you seen that? It looks amazing. 14 pitches, 9-hole golf course on it. I liked your comeback. Go and argue with some Northampton fans.
I agree, Tim. The point is, I agree with everything you've just said. Why are they dragging us into it? He's put a tweet out about Dolphins fans. Enjoy the Premier League. Enjoy your lovely training ground. Enjoy your Premier League. Just leave us alone.
Because they just want, you know, if you've won that, you've done well, you want to mock your rivals in it. But you, as you always say, they're not your rivals. Right. Do you enjoy Christmas football?
Yeah, best time of the year.
I love it as well. And it makes the Premiership, it makes, well, English football in a total. It makes it fantastic. And every year there's someone, isn't there, who says, oh, there's too much football at Christmas. And I always think, shut up. You know, you're paid to do this crap and we love it. And it's, you always get crap, weird results, don't you? And stuff like that. So and the Boxing Day fixture is always great, isn't it? Something to look forward to on Boxing Day. Today's letter is D. There are lots of them, so we're going to have to sort of sub it down because we came up with about 30, didn't we? So yeah. We've just got a few here. So today's letter is D. So after this week's podcast, there's only 24 of the shows left until we hit Z for Zidane. And then that's it. We're finishing the podcast. End of. Have you got any mail?
Yes, an email this week. Interestingly, you've already touched on it, but from a Leicester City fan.
Pride of the Midlands.
Yeah. The thing that made me laugh about this podcast, this email was, they've actually put, hi, Blake Fallows and Tim. So it's like this three people.
Well, you are plural, so
yeah. It's from Scott, Leicester fan, and he says, I used to be a regular Leicester City goer, attending at every possible opportunity. This season, for the first time, I saw a player score a goal and turn to the ref for approval before he celebrated, and nothing quite hammered home how ridiculous the game has become. I don't quite know how they've got it so wrong. Multiple other sports have adapted and used this kind of technology for the better, and yet week in, week out, our conversations have gone from, did you see that goal? Or what an awesome move, to it should have been ruled out. Why have they not checked that? It seems the pundits and ex-pros in the studio agree with the masses, and it begs the question, why isn't there an ex-pro on as the fourth or fifth official checking these things with a ref who can give an actual, realistic footballing sense and point of view rather than one of these officials, whatever these officials read about. I now found much more joy watching my local non-league team, Shepshed Dynamo, once managed by Martin O'Neill, it says here, so local to Leicester. The realism and passion hasn't been diluted by arguing whether someone was offside by a centimetre, and I actually love the human error side of it, weirdly, not to mention all the people involved in non-league football.
Yeah, as I always say, football has become a metaphor for life. Everyone wants everything to be fair, and by trying to make everything fair, because life's just not fair, is it? You know, we've got the birth lottery to begin with. You know, you're born into wherever you're born into, with whatever parents you have and whatever else it is, you know, and then we want everything to be fair. And the, you know, I don't know how many times we have to say it, VAR is just not working. Just take it away. Go and work it out and then bring it back in a new version of it. They're trying to get it to do too much and be too accurate. We've got some tweets in as well. Simon Robinson said, it was C last week, D this week, C last week. And we talked about Clive Thomas. And do you remember, it was the corner kick in the World Cup and the ball came over and he blew the whistle as the ball was in the air. Zico puts the ball in the net and Brazil would have won the match. And it was just, I mean, if you haven't seen it, I've put it on my social media. Go and have a look at it because it is ridiculous. My oldest memories is Clive Thomas last game, which was the final game of the season, winner takes all, to stop up Stoke versus Wolves, 1983, I think, in Division One. Mr. Thomas awarded Stoke two penalties, sent Andy Gray off and retired a hero in Stoke. I love the fact that they, you know, it, whatever Clive Thomas did, it was wrong. Martin Gibbons says, we also did the poll last week, and the poll was, which is more important to you, the Premier League, the Champions League, the FA Cup, or don't care. And the Premier League won, but Martin Gibbons said, just want to quantify, Tim, the league shows the overall success, the overall across the season, the best team wins. I still believe there is the magic of the FA Cup. Theoretically, I could play non-league with my mates at the lowest level, qualify to play prelim, and they could go all the way. Imagine that. And I do think he's got a very good point. The one good thing about the FA Cup is the small teams get to play against the big team and go on cut runs, and we always love that. And then another guy, Sir Martin Thompson, says, if it counts for anything, the Premier League is the only one of the three in which you face the rest of the teams in the competition. Good point. Well made. And Klopp is King said, the league says more about you, the bread and butter, so to speak, but the prestige of winning the Champions League is unrivaled. I don't agree with him, but Klopp is King is clearly a Liverpool fan. They've got a massive, fantastic relationship with the European Cup, haven't they? A bit like Nottingham Forest, as you would know. And because of that, I think they, Liverpool fans, have a special relationship with it more than others. As promised on last week's show, every week we'll bring you a Brian Clough quote, because, you know, he is the man. And all his quotes are really not PC at all. After reading through them, but it's context. It was back then, but they wouldn't survive now. He was talking about dealing with Roy Keane. Listen to this one. I only ever hit Roy once. He got up, so I couldn't have hit him that hard. Can you imagine one of the managers coming out now and saying, well, I battered one of my players, but only once. Right, on with D's, Blake. And I'm going to go first because this goes on to the poll. I want to get the poll going. So the first D I've got is dive. Now, I've said this before. A dive used to be thought of as disgusting behaviour, conning your teammates, conning the fans, conning the sport, basically. It was, you know, there was this great thing where it was like, that's what foreigners do. That's what they do in Europe. We don't do that over here. We stay on our feet and we play football. We play like men. We're men. And then the dive got rebranded. It got remarketed by strikers. And it was called, he has the right to go down. That's what it became known as. I think it was like the strikers union got together and said, how do we get the public on our side so we can just cheat, basically? And even more, the new language entered the game. Pundits kept saying things like, he has to go down there and win his side a penalty. Do you get that? That word win. You've got to win your side a penalty. They actually use the word win to describe a dive. Putting a positive spin on something which we all kind of hate. And if the player did play to the rules, the pundits would say the manager will be furious that he didn't go down there, making the player who actually played to the rules, the proper player, make him out to be the villain. So us, the fans, we've also slowly been getting brainwashed into believing that contact in the box is a chance to win a penalty. Absolutely disgraceful. And this slowly leaked further and further and further onto the pitch until now you've got the fullback going down if he gets touched, you know. And that's where we're at with, you know, as I've always said, if you can listen to this podcast, you're going to hear me bang on about no contact a lot. And I'll tell you what you should do, right? Original Ronaldo, you know, Brazilian Ronaldo. There's a great footage of him. I might have mentioned this before, Blake, on this podcast. This is fantastic footage of him scoring all his goals. Someone's done a compilation. It's great. And what's really great is at the beginning of his career, because he was just on the crossover of when it started changing. And the beginning of his career, he's riding tackles. It's so beautiful watching a striker ride a tackle, like Maradona, you see, do it. And, you know, all the greats do it. And then towards the end of his career, you can see the sort of bit where he starts going down a bit. And it's like, because he's learning to win a penalty, which, you know, just doesn't. What do you think about this, Blake?
Well, firstly, I love the idea of all the strikers and attacking players getting together and hiring a PR company sometime in the early 2000s again. Right, how do we rebrand diving? My first memory of diving was, again, Leicester. Robbie Savage dived in the last minute for Leicester. They won 3-2. He won the penalty, dived against Craig Burley. And I remember Craig Burley grabbing him around the throat straight away, And then afterwards, in the tunnel, the old style tunnel that used to come out, the tunnel was going from side to side as Craig Burley basically went mad at Robbie Savage. So I think that was just before the crossover.
What do you think of Robbie Savage? Because obviously he was like a Leicester legend, and then he comes and chips up at your club. What do you think?
Yeah,
did you like him there?
Yeah, I think he's one of them players that if he doesn't play for you, you hate him, and as soon as he signs for you, you love him.
Yeah.
But he also signed during a very, very difficult time when we finished bottom of the Premier League with 11 points, the lowest ever top flight total.
You won't remember this, Blake, but back in the day on the old Match of the Day, this might have been in the 80s when it was the best football ever. I'm so sad you missed out on that, Blake.
Back in my day.
Do you know Mickey T, Mickey Thomas?
Mickey Thomas,
for Chelsea, Man United. And there was this brilliant bit of footage. The older listeners here will remember this. Mickey T went down and he sort of... he dived basically, but then the camera there, and he dives, and then he turns to the camera and gives it a wink.
Oh no!
They put it on the Match of the Day credits for years, but it was that thing of, you know, he was cheeky chappy doing that, and everyone knew it was a dive. But now it's a clever thing to do, isn't it? So
yeah, but also in the 70s, Franny Lee used to do it when Derby were champions of England twice. Franny Lee used to do it in the 70s, and it was a thing, diving. And like you say, it's become the new thing that you're winning a foul rather than cheating.
Sorry, were Derby in top flight football once?
Yeah, champions of England twice.
When was that? What years were those?
72 and 75.
They didn't even make it into the 80s, the best football ever. Right, so let's do a poll, Blake. How sad's that? That was like 50 years before you were born or something. Right. Let's do this poll. Let's ask our listeners. We'll go to Twitter, basically. Do you have the right to go down if touched in the box? Yes. Choice one. No. Choice two. And don't care. Choice three. We've got a great interview coming up in a minute, by the way. I'm not going to tell you who it is. You're going to have to wait and see, but you're going to love it. You know, obviously, who it is, Blake, but the listener doesn't. Right, I've tweeted that out. We'll see how that goes at the end of the show. Right, what's your first D, Blake? I'm excited about this. What you got for me?
My first D is the D. The D of the area.
Love it. Clever. That's the one everyone goes, what's it there for?
Well, I'm about to bust that. Firstly, do you know what the D's official name is?
No.
The penalty arc.
Ah.
The actual definition of it, the curved part of the D is an arc of a circle, radius of 10 yards, centred on the penalty spot. So when a player is taking the penalty, only the penalty taker and the opposing goalkeeper obviously can stand in the box. So the purpose of the D is that you know you can't be within 10 yards of the person taking the penalty. So it's the penalty arc. I never knew it had a use. I just thought it was kind of just
there for decoration. I just think it's a bit farcical that it's there, though. I get it, but it just makes it more hard work for the groundsmen who have to get the perfect arc round. I suppose they enjoy doing it. Right, my next D is the drop ball. And I miss the drop ball, like everybody, you know, with my rose-tinted spectacles. You get two psychopaths on the pitch, you drop a ball between them and you watch them kick lumps out of each other. It was great. As a player, you were in sticks, weren't you? So you didn't get to do drop ball. I absolutely hate it. If there was a drop ball near me, I was like, I don't want to get involved in that because it just hurts. And I love the tackle, but drop ball, the kicks used to come right up thigh high and stuff, you know. But last season, did you know that drop balls can no longer be contested? You know, it's out of the game. I know it stopped happening anyway because the one team would go, oh, they had the ball, let's give it back to them. But it's literally in the Premier League, this is, I don't know if it's all football. If players stop, the ball will be dropped to a player on the team that last touched the ball and where they touched it. All other players must be 4.5 yards away, which is 4 meters to us modern folk. What that means is if a team's attack is stopped, they will get the ball back in that position instead of the opponents booting the ball back down the field. However, any play stopped in a penalty area will be returned to the goalkeeper, even if the attacking team had the ball. So that's your drop ball, which is no longer in the game, which is sad when that leaves. What's your next D?
Doing a Leeds.
Doing a Leeds.
Which is an expression maybe more with the lower leagues and especially the Championship, which is the teams that come down, once great teams that come down from the Premier League, but then go down again. And there's often Derby fans and other Championship fans often talk about, oh, maybe we need a season in League One just to rebuild. Like, look at Leicester. So the teams like Leicester, Sunderland, Charlton, teams that have been in the Premier League and gone down to the Championship and then gone down again to League One. So it's always, it's called doing a Leeds.
I didn't know anything about this, doing a Leeds. But you say there's a Wikipedia page to it now.
Yeah, so I actually looked into, I thought of this as a D, searched it to see if there was any stats or anything, and there's actually a full Wikipedia page with sub-menus and everything on it, like doing a Leeds, Leeds Days, the fall of Leeds United. There's a whole thing on it, and it's just an expression that's used by lower league fans. And interestingly, this is a stat that surprised me. 23 teams that have been in the Premier League since its inception in 1992 have gone down to the third tier, to League One.
I'll name some of them. Go on.
Like we say, Charlton, Sunderland, Bradford. Bradford are now bottom of League One, League Two, sorry. So Bradford have gone from being in the Premier League under Paul Jewell in 2000, right down to the bottom. So on the verge of non-league football, having played in the Premier League, Oldham, Swindon. They were in the initial...
What is going on with Leeds at the moment? I don't know if you saw the game against United the other night. And it was a great game of football, but they got absolutely hammered, right? Literally hammered.
Yes.
But Martin Tyler was just kept on going on about... It's like you're watching Barcelona or something. It's like, no, they got hammered. What is it that everybody thinks Leeds are just... I mean, they are great to watch, but they're getting hammered still.
But even Gary Neville, the biggest Man United fan you'll ever meet on television, was praising Leeds when they're 6-2 down at Old Trafford. They've conceded 6 goals in the Premier League. I don't see that. It was so open.
And United have had such a horrific season, winning for once against a team which everyone's saying. And no one's mentioning United. They're just talking about Leeds. And Leeds have good PR. The same people who PR'd the penalty, for a penalty. PRing Leeds. Look, do your next one as well. Let's get this next one because it leads nicely into my other one. So your next one is your Dennis Bergkamp, yeah?
Yeah. Dennis Bergkamp's turn on Nico Dabizas was a fluke, I think. It's Dennis Bergkamp's turn, the famous goal against Newcastle at St James's Park. The ball, Vieira plays the ball straight into Bergkamp's feet on just inside the box. He kind of flicks the ball around one way, turns the other way, place it into the net. Widely regarded as one of the greatest goals in Premier League history. I think it's a fluke.
All right, D for Dennis Bergkamp turn. All right, why I've got to tell you this. I have sat and watched that so many times since you told me that. I was like, he just came on and we go, what have you got for D? I want to do Dennis Bergkamp turn. By the way, it's a fluke. I went, what? And it's like one of the greatest goals ever. And I've sat and watched it over and over again. And now I can't make up my mind. I think he's so, because Dennis Bergkamp, when you watched him, he was so in tune with the game. That team, that Arsenal team were. Like Henri, everything he touched was golden. His control was phenomenal. And Bergkamp was similar. He was just in that golden phase of his career. And I just believe he just sort of, you know, just magicked that out of nowhere. And now I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, he's there looking in his eyes going, hold on, the ball's come through to me.
The more you watch it, the more it'll get in your head. So stop watching it because I can't stop. I watched it just before we started recording to try and back myself up. I thought, I can't go on a podcast and say that was a fluke. But I watched it again. And the more you watch it, the more it just messes with your mind. It's a fluke.
All right. Well, moving on from there, because talking of flukes, whether it was or wasn't, the 2002 World Cup, South Korea and Japan, Paul Scholes does a horrible tackle on Cliveson. And way outside the box, I don't know if you remember this. You look at Paul Scholes, the way he tackled, and you're like, mate, have you ever played football? I mean, he's one of the greatest footballers, right, we've seen in this country. But the boy, just like, it's just such a dumb tackle. Anyway, he does it. But it's miles outside the box and no one cares. Seaman's in goal. Ronaldinho steps up, right, way outside the box. And he just hoofs the ball. And then there's the controversy because Ron Atkinson goes over Seaman's head. He's off the line. Do you remember this goal?
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah, of course.
Seaman's
off
the line. Seaman looks completely like just, I don't know, he looks so upset and his whole world has just fallen apart. Cut away to Sven. He looks terrible. The Brazil players are going absolutely mental. And then Ron Atkinson says there's two people really surprised about that. That's David Seaman and Ronaldinho. And he said something like, it's a fluke. He was just playing it into the hole. Then later on afterwards, they interview Ronaldinho and say, come on, was it a fluke or did you mean to do it? And again, it's one of those I've watched a million times. He said, no, I meant to do it. It's called the dry leaf. And so it's D for dry leaf. And that was the free kick technique. And the dry leaf means you stick a ball up in the air as far as I can understand. And then it drops quickly. So he threw it up in the air and then it dropped quickly. It's a technique. And it is there is a free kick called a dry leaf. I think that's his interpretation from Brazil. But that's what he said. So what do you think? Was that one a fluke as well? Do you remember it enough?
Yeah, that was like when I first really got into football. So that's when you first get in and I was mad about football. If any other player in the world did that at that time, then you just say fluke. If it was Gary Neville taking a like free kick from the right wing and it lobs him and he fit. But Ronaldinho just had that in him, didn't he? That little touch of genius. I mean, he did it at Chelsea, didn't he? With a little toe poke and everyone was just, what's just happened? He had that little bit of genius.
He's a special player, isn't he? I mean, Eric. Unbelievably good. When you say you just started going to football, who did you go to football with throughout the time? Because you went 13 years, home and away, man and boy, 13 years. You were straight off the dock, straight down to... You don't have any docks in Derby, do you? What's your industry? The pits, the mines, straight out of the mines, straight down to the...
With Mr. Fallows Senior, me old man.
Did you go with your dad?
Yeah.
I love that. I love that about football when all the family go together. That's great. Okay, so I've done the dry leaf. What's your next D?
Diamond.
Oh, diamond formation.
Yes.
Or diamond lights. We could have done diamond lights. Diamond lights. Wasn't that a song that didn't Glenn Hoddle and Kevin Keegan do a song together? Was it though? No. No, what am I talking about? Hoddle and Waddle. Or was it Keegan? Who did Diamond Lights, the song?
I don't know. Was it in the 80s?
Well, if it was Keegan, it might have been the 70s. Well, I'm just going to look this up. Right, you tell us about diamond formation while I look this up.
So I like to throw a proper footballing one in there. We've had the Christmas tree formation last week, and the diamond is 4-4-2, a very attacking 4-4-2 formation, really.
Breaking news. Sorry, Blake. Breaking news. It was Glenn and Chris. It was them. They did Diamond Lights. I'll just do the first couple of lines of the lyrics of the song. Eyes that freeze like ice, cold electric blue, those diamond lights. You were hard as stone, solid stone for me. That was it. Classic song.
Sounds like a right tune.
From 19, that'll be 80s, when football was amazing. 1987, when the glory days of football. Go on, tell me about it. Diamond formation. I think I know who invented the diamond formation. Who did it? Who do you think it was? I thought it was Johan Cruyff, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I read a couple of different names. So I didn't want to name one in case I got it wrong. But it's like the last inception of the traditional 4-4-2, isn't it? It's like the last. It's the last formation 4-4-2 wise. It still gets played. I think Chelsea.
The diamond's 3-4-3, isn't it?
No, it's 4-4-2, but the four midfielders are in a diamond.
I thought the diamond, they went to three, back three. And that's the problem we had with England, wasn't it? Didn't we have... Anyway, the diamond formation never worked for England, did it? Even though they all wanted to play it because we had Lampard and Gerrard. And they're like, they can't play together. None of them want to sit back, do they? Blah, 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 you know, et cetera, et cetera. Rather than build it around the team, we build it around a formation. I thought the diamond, we went 3-4-3. I thought that's the way they play. Well, maybe they do it the other way as well. But I thought that's what I thought the holding midfielder sat in front of the back four, didn't he? And then became like a centre half. I'm talking like I know about football here.
Please interrupt me, Blake.
yeah, please do. Isn't it about giving the team width? Anyway, I'll just leave before I get myself in too much crap. I played 4-4-2. It was the 80s. We played the ball into the channel. That's what we did. Play the ball into the channel. So
turn him over.
Get it in the mixer. Always had a big lad up front. That's the way I play football. All this skill stuff. We've got to talk. When we get to S, we've got to do skills. Actually, S will do Showboat. I've got a good story to tell you about Showboats. Right, so I'm on to my next D here. This is Davis. By the way, we've got a guest coming up in a minute, which you're going to love, I promise you. It's a great guest. We'll tell you about him in a minute. But we'll go on to David's, because there's a long line of footballing David. So, you know, I have to crack through a few of these. There's David Seaman. We just mentioned him. There's David Speedy. There's David Batty. There's David Hurst. David Hurst, I work with a guy called Dan. Every time he was bigger when we were working together. And every time we mentioned him, he used to sing David Hurst, Disco Pants Are the Best. They go right up to his chest. I can't remember the song. I was thinking, why the hell did he sing that? At the time, I didn't even bother wondering. David Hurst, Disco Pants. If anyone knows why that was sung about David Hurst, God knows why. But anyway, who's your favourite David in football?
As a goalkeeper, David Seaman.
David Seaman. Any good Davids play for Derby? I'm putting you on the spot there.
Yeah, you are. not that I can think of, and I'm normally a bit of a statue with Derby.
Well, if one comes to you.
Leave that with me. Leave that with me. I'll think of a Derby David.
There'll be Derby fans screaming at this, going, what about David? okay, so who would you say was the most influential David from football?
Beckham.
Well, that's what everyone would say. But on this podcast, we like to think outside the box. And I would say the most influential David ever from football has to be David Icke. David Icke. He played youth football for Coventry and then he was in goal for Hereford United. He became injured, I think. In 1981, Icke became a sports presenter for the BBC, their Newsnight programme, which 2 years later, in 1983, appeared on the first edition of BBC Breakfast Time, British Television's national breakfast show. So he's talking to the people and that's what he's doing. He's influencing. 1985 to 83, he co-hosted Grandstand. Oh, that was a great show back in the 80s. that was BBC's flagship sports show. And then out of nowhere, he became the son of God. It's true. He's written more than 20 books. He's lectured in over 25 countries. He sells out Wembley Arena. Do you know that?
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
He is unbelievable, this guy. And I can't help myself but watch him.
Do you know what? David Icke's son, Gareth Icke, massive Derby fan and lives in Derby.
Does he? I wonder what he thinks. Does he believe in all his dad's stuff? You never know. David Icke might be right. As David Icke once said, I think he was on Wogan, where he said they all laughed at Jesus when he said the son of God. So he was. What happened to him is in 1990, he was a spokesperson of the Green Party. He visited a psychic who informed Icke he'd been placed on Earth for a purpose and Icke would begin to receive messages from the spirit world. These events led him to announce the following year that he was the son of Godhead. And then he said that the world would be devastated by tidal waves and earthquakes. But he's like king of the... It didn't happen, by the way. We're still here. He basically... is Mr. Conspiracy Theorist. It's absolutely incredible. He's been taken off Twitter and everything now because people listen to him a lot. He was one of the guys who said 5G was going to kill us or something, or spreading coronavirus. I don't even get involved with it because I'm not that interested. But he believes the universe is made up of vibrational energy. This football podcast has taken a turn, hasn't it? Like this. But he claims there's an interdimensional race of reptilian beings called... Archons or Anuakai that have hijacked the Earth, the genetically modified human hybrid race of shape-shifting reptilians. I think he believes the royal family are reptiles as well. Anyway, that's what it is. He is the most influential David. The second most influential David is probably David Beckham, who I did a documentary with him back in the day, and I've got to say I thoroughly enjoyed that. He is huge, and I've said this as a joke a lot, but I think all footballers should maybe have to donate like a percentage of their salary to him, because what he did for football when he arrived, he was so good at being famous, and he just put football on the map. Before Beckham, right, came, footballers weren't allowed in nightclubs. They were like, well, not the good ones anyway. It was like, you go over there, hang out with pastry girls and go to the local disco. Beckham comes along. He makes football so cool. I genuinely think this. And he's like, he's very good at being famous. He suddenly, everyone wants to hang out with him. He's hanging out with, I don't know, Elton John and whoever else, all the big stars, him and Posh. And they just became absolutely huge. And the time I was doing the documentary, he was living and playing football in Madrid. And it just... absolutely incredible that his life out there and how much he was worshipped. And I've got to say this, all the Beckham haters, he loves football. He just, every time he talks about football, he just came alive and he just loved it. And he was shit hot at it as well. I mean, his passing ability and scoring that free kick against Greece. And I mean, the guy actually delivered as well, scoring from the halfway line. And I know people like to knock him because he's so successful, but he was good. I'll tell you a very quick story. I said to him, what's it like? What's it like before the games? You know, because it was the Galacticos at Real Madrid. And I said, what's it like? And he goes, well, all the guys, you know, the Brazilian stuff, they will do like the keepy uppies and stuff like that. And I said, would you join in with them? He goes, no, they won't let me. They say I'm English, so I don't have any skill. It was brilliant. And he laughed and he thought it was fun. I could tell you, as the podcast goes, and I'm sure there'll be other opportunities to tell you more about that. But that doing that documentary was fantastic. And it just got me thinking, actually, because there's been eras in football at the moment. And, you know, because you're the youth on this podcast, there was the Keegan era. There was like Keegan and Brooking. That was a big era, Keegan. Then we had the Lineker era. I'm talking about English football here, England, the national team. Then we had the Gazza era. Then we had the Beckham era. What's now? What have we got? The Kane era, the Sterling era. Have we got a superstar? And if we haven't, does that mean we're more of a team and we can go on to win? What are we thinking? Is there one?
Is Grealish a little bit too naughty? Gets up to a few antics, doesn't he? He's in the paper a bit too much.
But he's in and out of the team. He's not like you think about Gazza. As soon as he got in, was in. Beckham got in. You know, Gazza, Lineker, they all just would. They've just played the game, and that was everyone loved them and worshipped them, and that was it. You know what? We haven't got one of those at the moment, have we? But do we need one? Maybe this is the time that we don't have one, and the team can win.
Well, you look at like we say 2000s, early 2000s, the golden generation. My first England team. We were spoiled. When you look back at the players we had 11 world class would get in any team in the world footballers, and it didn't work. So maybe you're right.
Right, I want to get on to our interview, but just before that, we've got to do our numbers. We're going up against each other. Do you want to go first or second?
I'll go second this week.
Okay, I'm going to go first. 111. That is the list of foreign players that have played in the Premier League. That is brilliant. 111 different nationalities out of the 207 FIFA registered nationalities. 111 have played in the Premier League. That is a great start. We should be celebrating that.
That's brilliant.
Our league is just like there. It's brilliant. I love that. Do you know the last team which fielded a totally English team?
In the top flight or just in English?
Top flight. Yeah.
Liverpool.
Nah, weren't they the first team to, in the 1986 FA Cup final, they had a team with no English.
That's probably what I'm thinking of.
But they were made up of like Irish players like Lawrenson and stuff like that. So it's sort of one of those strange facts. But it was Villa, John Gregory's Villa, 27th of February 1999. It had Michael Oakes, Steve Watson, Gareth Southgate, Dion Dublin, Simon Grayson, Ricardo Schmeichel, Alan Wright, Lee Hendry, Paul Merson, Ian Taylor and Julian Joachim. And they lost against Coventry. I think it was 2-1, 3-1, something like that. But that was the last time. So it's interesting. But anyway, 111 different nations played in the Premier League. What's your one?
63.
Ah, 63. The first year that, I don't know, last time Spurs won anything?
The number of decisions that have been overturned by VAR so far this season.
Wow, that's a great one. You win that, definitely. Your facts are better than mine. Mine are crap. That is brilliant. 63. Got to say, we are just recording this just before Boxing Day. So by the time we've got through that Christmas fixture, a Boxing Day could be up in the hundreds.
Yeah, it'd be about 2,000 by the 27th. Yeah.
Right, listen, my next D, you're going to like that. You won that, by the way, numbers this week. You've won two in a row. Definitely. That is such a great fact. 63, love it. Okay, so my next D is Danny Cowley, proving football is the greatest sport on earth and fairy tales do happen. Danny was a PE teacher when he got into management with his brother, Nicky. They lived the dream, having extraordinary cup runs and promotions. The pair went from non-league Concord Rangers to Braintree to Lincoln and then to Championship Huddersfield. Here he is now. We're speaking to D for Danny Cowley. Hi, Danny. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Tim. How are you?
Oh, yeah, dreamy, thank you. Danny, look, we've got a lot of Premier League ponces listening to this podcast, so I think the best thing we need to do is run to a quick history of kind of the fairy tale of your career, because you were you were a PE teacher before you started out in management, weren't you?
This is it, yeah. So I would have taught at a school in Essex, Fitzwymark School, which had a brilliant extracurricular tradition. So we used to play a lot of sport there, both in school and after school. Spent 15 years there. Actually, my brother and my wife all taught at the school, so we had three Cowleys, which was a little bit confusing for the children. But no, loved the school there. Had some brilliant times and still in contact with a lot of the staff and a lot of the pupils.
And then what happened? How did you move from there into management and then end up managing Huddersfield in the Championship?
Well, I had a non-league playing career, so I played, I suppose, the equivalent to what is the Conference South now. So maybe that is step six, tier six. Love football. It's always the first thing I thought about when I woke up, the last thing I thought about when I went to bed. My dad played. He kind of introduced us to the game. I'll be forever thankful to him for doing that. And then one day I remember just picking up an injury back end of one season. Thought it was quite innocuous. Thought I'd get over it. Played the rest of the season. I think we were having quite a good year chasing a league title and some cup competitions. Played on with it. Rested in the summer, thought I was going to get over it, didn't. Then started to do some rehab, couldn't get over it. About 18 months in, had a number of operations. Believe it or not, they were like, at that time, they were pumping collagen, which you kind of, I think people put in their lips now. They were pumping that into a tent and trying to get to a place where I could play again. And ultimately realised that I couldn't. And it's, without over-dramatising it, it's when you love something and it's taken away from you, you kind of go into a mourning period and it's like, oh my God, what do I do next? And because I've taught, I suppose some of the skills that you develop through teaching are transferable to coaching and to football management. And I can remember Nicky, my brother, he would have been playing at the time and he was doing quite well. There was a team that wanted him, but he was playing at a bit of a higher level, a couple of divisions higher. So Concord Rangers wanted to sign him. He probably at that time didn't have any interest of going there. But I actually was, because we used to drive together because we used to live close together to school. So after school, we had to go and visit them and go and see them and met the manager and the chairman. And the guy who'd just taken over wanted to carry on playing. And he'd kind of fallen into this management role. And I kind of got a feeling off the back of that meeting that they really wanted Nicky. They didn't have any interest in me. My career had kind of finished, but I kind of realised that I could probably use Nicky to get me in at Concord Rangers if I said, look, if you want me to come in and coach or be joint manager, then I reckon I could probably sign Nicky, and actually I could probably sign a couple of other friends that played at a good level that were kind of my peers and still playing. So that's how it all started, really. Yeah, Nicky would have gone there with no intention of really signing at Concord Rangers, but off the back of that, it kind of provoked a thought in mine, and I talked Nicky into coming, and Nicky actually at the time didn't want to come. I can remember Dad trying to talk him out of coming. I'm saying, look, Nick, if you come, I think that this could be the start of something for me. And I think me and Nicky were probably always a little bit frustrated with kind of the provision that we had as non-league footballers, maybe the coach, the quality of the coaching, the quality of the environment and the culture that we were involved in at that level. And my aim and my ambition was to try to make something better. And yeah, that's kind of how it all started. And lucky enough to pick three promotions up at Concord Rangers. And it was just a brilliant club, family club, and fantastic to see them continue to develop to this day.
So you went from Concord Rangers to Braintree Town, and then Lincoln City came in for you. I mean, that must have been quite a big thing. What division were they in when Lincoln came into you? They were non-league, weren't they?
So they were National League, yeah. So they'd been relegated from the Football League 5 years ago, and they'd spent the first 5 years in non-league. Kind of, they hadn't finished above 13th, and they'd just lost their way as a club, really. Lost its enthusiasm, lost its direction. It was kind of that place where the board was waiting for the players. The players were waiting for the board. There was no real sort of clarity or vision of what they were trying to achieve. And it came from nowhere, really. Everyone said, did you have aspirations to get into a full-time football? We had 8 years at Concord, we got to a place at Concord, the Conference South, which was, we'd had three promotions. We were right on the edge of the playoffs. The club had said to us they didn't want to get promoted. And it was on that moment that we thought, oh, we want to go to the National League.
When you say we, that's you and your brother, Nicky, isn't it?
Yeah, that would have been Nicky. So Nicky would have played for me for the first seven seasons. And then his body gave up on him. And then he was player coach and then moved into sort of assistant management role. So we went to Concord, had a brilliant year there with just the most unbelievable group of players. We inherited Alan Devonshire's team. So my dad's favourite ever player would have been Alan Devonshire.
West Ham legend.
Yeah, he was a West Ham legend and we were obviously big West Ham supporters. So yeah, that was stepping into big shoes at the time. But what Alan had done, he'd left a brilliant group of players and we inherited them and kind of took them into staying because I think they might have been leaving, but had just the most wonderful year as a part-time team in what was in the National League at that time. I think about 20 of the clubs were full-time. So we managed to finish third, and back end of that season, people started to say that there was some interest from full-time clubs. And then you have that decision to make because you're in the most secure industry in the world in teaching. You pretty much have to commit murder to lose your job in teaching, to then go into the world of football management where you know it's a pretty fragile industry as everybody knows. But once the opportunity come, it's like, you know, when it's been your dream your whole life and it's something that, you know, you just couldn't turn down. So we knew as soon as Lincoln come knocking, really, that we were going to take that opportunity. And my dad actually tells me now he wanted to talk us out of it. And obviously, wow. Dad for us would have been, he was out. You know, he played football, he introduced us to the game. He was a coach himself, so he was an A-licensed coach. So he coached us all the way through and was obviously always involved in the decision-making process, really. But he kept quiet because I think he knew he couldn't talk us out of it anyway.
So he took Lincoln back into the league. And then I became aware of you for all your cup runs. I mean, you had some amazing times there, didn't you?
Yeah, we had a brilliant time at Lincoln. Really, it just worked. Do you know what? When we took the job, it was like we knew it was a really good job because I think every club has its natural ceiling, but it also has its natural floor. And Lincoln was at rock bottom, really. And we knew that we could pick it up and we didn't have to be very good to make it better than it was. And yeah, we went there. And I can remember the first day, I can remember sitting in a board meeting. It was literally first day that we'd taken a job, early May, we'd come out of teaching, sitting in this board meeting. It was May half term, and I was watching the kids, and the kids were in a Lincoln City soccer school, and they're all playing. There's about 60, 70 kids, and there was just one Lincoln City kit. All the other kids, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Man United, Man City, Liverpool, Arsenal, Tottenham, just one Lincoln City kit. And I remember nudging Nicky and said, "We've got to change that. We've got to do something about that." And the board meeting carried on, went on and on and on. We managed to get outside, get some fresh air. And I remember talking to this little boy, and he must have been maybe 11, 12. And I spoke to him about Lincoln City. And I can remember him talking out the corner of his mouth, and he was almost embarrassed to support the club. And I remember on that day saying to Nicky, like, this is it. This is what the vision is. We've got to make Lincoln City cool. We've got to make it cool again to support Lincoln City. Forget Lincoln City being everybody's second team or third team. No, this is Lincoln City. And the unique part or the unique thing with Lincoln is that it's a bit off the beaten track. You kind of don't go through Lincoln. Unless you actually go into Lincoln, you don't go through it. But it's the most beautiful city. It's just a wonderful city. Got a beautiful cathedral, kind of these cobble streets. It's like quintessential Britain. And the people have a huge allegiance with the city. Like, let's be honest, there's not many places where a sausage is named after the area. And that is what Lincoln is. And the people have such an allegiance, not with the football club at that time, but with the city. And that was really powerful to us. And yeah, without that, the cup run was pretty special. We kind of started in the fourth qualifying round, drew 0-0 with Guiseley in probably one of the worst games in football history. Managed to win the replay, and then we got going, and it was the second round, actually. We played in front of the television cameras, which was a big thing at the time for Lincoln because it was good money. So it was a Monday night, and it was a really foggy night in Lincoln. We went 3-0 up against Oldham, who were a League One team at the time, blew them away. They come back in the game, and then the fog descended. And we'd gone when we started at Lincoln, there was about 2,000 supporters. Well, we'd had 5,500 on that day, and they all got their camera phones out and all put their torches on, and you had this wonderful moment. And my hair's in the back of my neck stand up as I talk about it. I can just remember all the supporters having their lights on. It was like you were at Robbie Williams concert. Huh. And yeah, it kind of, and they were trying to disperse the fog because we were worried that the game was going to end up getting called off. But it was on that night really that we thought, oh, we're onto something here. We've got a connection. And really it kind of escalated from there.
I can see Blake trying to get in.
You're talking about the cup runs, and Tim mentioned it earlier, the promotions, cup runs, and obviously going on to managing the championship. Can you pick a career highlight to date so far?
Oh, winning the league at Macclesfield at Lincoln. That for me, it kind of, I completed non-league. So it was always, yeah, it was always our ambition to try to get promoted. We knew that if we were going to get to the Football League, we'd have to earn it because of the sort of playing career and where we'd come from as PE teachers. But that day at Macclesfield, we knew how important it was for the club, first and foremost. It was so important for the club to get back in the Football League. And it was a sellout. There was 10,000 people there. And what people don't remember in that year, I think we played 67 games because we'd had this ridiculous FA Cup run. We'd got to the semi-final of the FA Trophy as well. And we just had a huge, huge run of games. And literally in April, we were dead on our feet. And we kept coming back. We went into the Torquay game and the Gateshead game. We were dead on our feet. Literally, both games we were losing going into injury time. And we turned both games round and won both games. So literally, I think it was Good Friday, we played Torquay, 1-0 down, scored 90th, 93rd. 1-0 down on Bank Holiday Monday against Gateshead. Awful. Probably our worst performance of the season. Scored 90th. Matt Reed scored a really important penalty, and then we scored in the 93rd minute. And it was kind of like it felt like the football gods. I'm a football romantist, so yeah, it felt like the football gods were with us for sure.
So with every good fairy tale, there's some bad bits which happen as well. And last season you took over Huddersfield, and at the end of the season they got rid of you. What do you think about your experience there?
Well, I think if you look for fairness in football, you're looking in the wrong place. I don't think life's fair, so I don't think we should expect it to be fair. And we all understand and respect that. We took over a club, I think they'd won once in 38 games when we took over. And really for us, it was the right time for everybody. The way our contracts had worked at Lincoln, there was £1 million compensation, which was a ridiculous amount of money for two PE teachers. But the club needed the money as well, Lincoln. So it was, and the nature of the contracts, it kind of, the money was going to diminish as the contracts run on. So it was the right time for everyone. And we looked at Huddersfield, and it was, I always look for the biggest challenge, because I think the bigger the challenge, the bigger the learning. And we'd never taken a job mid-season. We'd never managed in a championship. And there was a massive, you know, lure in terms of that and the level and the quality of players. We'd never managed players of different culture. And we'd all built at a lower level. We'd always been at the top of divisions in the sort of 12 seasons preceding that. So we'd never managed a relegation battle. So we felt like loads of learning here. Come on, let's. And we also felt exactly the same feeling when I met Bob Dorian, the Lincoln chairman. I felt like, oh, you need us. And we could really help you. I remember speaking to Bob Dorian, who was like a really old school football chairman, just loved the club. And the club had got relegated under his tenure, and he thought it was his fault. And you wanted to help him. And at Huddersfield, it felt like the club, I don't know, it felt like we could help the club. And we went in and I think they'd won once in 38 games. They'd had a horrific run in the Premier League. Had a really poor start. We had 1 point after 8 games. And we kept them in the division from a place that I don't think anybody has ever kept a team up from. So I think the perception is that we fouled, maybe because of the short nature of that role only being 10 months. But we managed to get to 50 points, which was the aim. And I think the disappointment from my point of view is that we got it to a place where we feel that we could have built from now. We genuinely felt that with the right work in a summer transfer window, that we would be able to get into the top half of the championship, which from where Huddersfield were would have been a big achievement. But that that opportunity didn't happen. And I think, you know, the chairman, Phil Hodgkinson, was a new chairman. He'd been a chairman in non-league. He was kind of this guy that had been a football coach, been a scout, been an agent. He loved football. His heart was in the right place, but he wanted to take the club in a different route. And ultimately, it's his club and it's his money. And you respect that, and you have that choice, don't you? You either get bitter or you try to get better. And you know, my aim is the former.
Is it nice that your name gets mentioned for the Sunderland job? Were you actually interviewed for it?
Yeah. We spoke to Sunderland. Sunderland's a huge club. Saw a lot of similarities between Sunderland and Lincoln. You know, with all respect to Lincoln, obviously Sunderland is a much bigger version and in League One, but certainly probably on the floor in terms of where they should be as a club. I mean, it's a huge football club with an unbelievable support. And we did speak to them, and you know, Lee Johnson has obviously got that role now, and Lee's someone that we know well. Managed against Lee a lot, managed against his dad Gary a lot as well, and they're great football people. And I think they've made a really good appointment in Lee Johnson. And I just genuinely hope for not just for Sunderland and their supporters, but for football that they're able to find their way back up.
But about you, Danny, it's nice that you're getting mentioned still with the huge roles like that, right?
Yeah, sometimes you have to pinch yourself because you know we've come a long way people think we've come a long way in a short space of time, and I genuinely think we've come a long way in a short space of time. But still, it's been kind of 13 years in the doing. It's taken 13 years to get to this point, and no one really knows how much work has gone into getting us to.
Well, Danny, I imagine you don't have a life, do you? When you get a football manager, become a football manager, how can you switch off?
It's hard, without a doubt. You know, I love football, so I always feel quite selfish, if I'm honest, because I don't see it as work. I would do it for nothing, because I love the game and love being part of it. And sometimes I feel selfish in the respect that I'm not spending the necessary time with my family, and I'm so. Nicky calls it a healthy obsession, and I suppose it is. But we certainly love the game. I don't always love the industry, but I love the game.
You're managing your daughter's team at the moment. Unbeaten now, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, they've done well. Yeah, they're under 12s.
Yes, Danny, proper football, grassroots.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we love grassroots football. So they're 12s. They're playing in an all boys league. So I think we're the only all girls team in an all boys league.
Brilliant.
It's great. It's brilliant. And the girls are just full of enthusiasm. It's interesting actually teaching boys and girls a different kind of coaching. The girls you only have to tell once. They're like sponges, and they're very coachable, where they don't quite have the same energy and intensity as the boys. So sometimes you have to drive that area. But where the boys are 100 miles per hour and just want to play, the girls are always, why are we doing this? And you haven't explained to them this drill for this context, and this is why we're doing it. But it's just great to see the girls playing. And, you know, girls football is developing by the day. And the quality now, compared to where it would have been maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, is just incredible. And
well, I've been watching women's football develop in the last 25 years. It is a completely different game. They are unbelievable. The skill level is phenomenal now. And the one thing I like about watching women's football is they don't go down, do they? They just keep playing. So, you know, even in, you know, international level, there's not all the diving around and all the histrionics. They just get on and play football like the good old days in the 80s, Blake. You remember the good old days.
This is it. My Isabella, she's I teach her, and she steps over the paint, do what you can to win, and she's pretty aggressive with some of the boys. And she was having a bit of a set two with one of the boys a couple of weeks ago, and I said to her, what were you saying to him? She said he kept pushing me. So I said, do you want a cuddle? The back of that boy didn't go near her for the rest of the game, which I thought was a stop comeback. Now she's having an argument with any of the boys.
Listen, final thing, Danny. If you are a coach out there, what is the What is the one little trick you can give them for success? What is the one thing you're looking at? Do you think you've learned that if you're an amateur coach doing your pub team or kids team or whatever, what's the one thing that you think would be a great piece of advice to go and get some victories under your belt?
I think for me, it's to make the children enjoy it. Get the children enjoying it and loving it. I just see so many grassroots coaches. Kind of, there's so much coaching now on YouTube, isn't there? You can watch Pep Guardiola or you can watch Jurgen Klopp sessions. And the mistake that we make is that we try to coach the children before they're ready to be coached. First thing is make them enjoy it, get them loving it. As soon as you get them to love the game, then they create a natural curiosity. And once they create that natural curiosity, then you can start to add a bit of detail and a bit of technical, tactical insight. But until that point, just make it fun. Make it really, really fun. Think of a million different ways of making the game and bringing the game to life. Because the hardest thing for the modern day coach is there's a lot of other distractions now for children, isn't there? There's, you know, you can pretty much sit on your computer and play real life games. So we have to fight this every single day. So we have to try to make it fun, make it enjoyable, get the kids curious. Once you get the kids curious, then naturally they wanna learn themselves. And for me, learning is so, I've been lucky enough to be involved in learning or education for the majority of my life. And learning's a skill and we forget it. And to me, it's probably the greatest skill that there is. And don't think that people just have it naturally, because I don't think people just have, you don't just wake up with the skill of learning. It's something that has to be nurtured and developed itself. So spend some time trying to work that out and do that. And for me, football is the greatest game in the world. So
it is.
As long as they leave it alone.
Well, that's the thing.
Guys,
we talk about that all the time on this. Bring contact back into the game. The ball's there to be won. We love that. And VAR is a joke. Bring it back when they know how to use it. Because it's
absolute
nonsense.
Nicky and I have been doing a piece of work at the moment as to where we think football will be in 10 years. Because as a coach, you want to be ahead of the curve if you can. You listen to Eddie Jones, who talks about this in rugby, and it just scares me where football's going. You know, when I think about tennis, I think we're going to get to a point where there'll be no heading. I think we're going to be at a point where maybe there's going to be like no throw-ins and there's going to be kick-ins. And I'm just scared. I'm scared of Kalina. He's the one. He was a great referee, but I don't like him. He worries me. He's in this position now where he just wants to make all these rule changes, and it just scares me because it's a beautiful game and it doesn't.
Yeah, well, the thing is, all three of us here play football. All three of us, when we play, want to win the ball, and that's part and parcel of the game. All three of us watch football and we want to see players win the ball. When you've got Xavi Alonso saying tackling isn't really a skill, you're like, what the hell? What game are you playing? Because the game we like is the one where you go and try and win the bloody ball. That's what everybody's looking for, and I think it's a real sad thing that it's the game is only for quick, skillful players, and then no one else is allowed in the game. We like the challenging, and we like the contact.
It's a contact, aggressive game. It's not a choreographed dance, and I'm scared that we're going to end up making it a choreographed dance. And where we're so interested in the aesthetics, it's always the blood, sweat, and tears for me. I'm a West Ham supporter, so you kind of, it's for us. You know, they always talk about the West Ham way, which I'm not sure that even exists, but for me it's the blood, sweat, and tears. It's actually interesting when we were speaking to Sunderland, and I remember speaking and just doing some background work really, as you would going into a job, and they were talking about their supporters. I remember them talking about Kevin, and I just assumed they were talking about Kevin Phillips, but actually they were talking about Kevin Ball, and that was what they wanted. They wanted that kind of up and at them, competitive, brave, courageous man. That's what they were looking for in their best player. And that's, you know, when they were talking about their best players, they were talking about Kevin Ball, not Kevin Phillips. Which,
Danny, thanks for joining us today. I'm just going to leave you on this because you're talking about players enjoying themselves. I've said to Blake before, I love watching players on the pitch enjoying themselves because football's such a great, I love the enjoyment in the game. But I really enjoyed the other day when Mika Richards said that and Roy Keane was listening. He said, players should play with a smile. And Roy Keane went, I don't like players playing with a smile. Yeah. He goes, you're not supposed to be smiling on a football pitch. And that is what I love about football, is the difference between some of the players go on and look, and then Roy Keane is like, I know, no smiling. You are deadly serious when you walk on the football pitch. Makes me laugh.
Yeah, I'm not sure I disagree with Roy Keane.
Brilliant. Danny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks,
man. Love to see you both.
Cheers. Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
What a great guy Danny is, don't you think, Blake?
Top bloke. Absolutely top bloke.
What an amazing story. Can you imagine being a PE teacher then ending up in the Championship? I mean, that's just incredible. Great stuff.
And what a big decision to make, because he could have gave everything up, gone to Lincoln and it gone a bit wrong, and then you've got to find a job. So, it's so brave as well.
Yeah, it's not a big decision to make to go into football, is it? You'd do it at a job for that. So, so would I. I'd give up my TV career if someone offered me the job of managing football. Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'd love to do it. I'd just love to do that. It'd be great. I think I'd be like a Arsene Wenger or Jose, you know. Didn't play at the top level, but came through to win leagues and stuff. Right. Just we're going to do the poll quickly here. So the poll for this week is, do you have a right to go down if touched in the box? What do you think? Yes, no, don't care. Have a guess.
Blake. I think no, around 55%.
What? You're doing well here. Yes has 34%. No has 50%. And don't care has 16%. I can't believe there's 34% people think you have a right to go down. You brainwashed idiots. just finish off with a couple of D's. We've got to do D for Deepdale because it's widely recognised as being the oldest continuously used football stadium in the world. Obviously, home of Preston North End. I've never been there. Have you been there?
Yeah, quite a few times, four or five times.
Nice stadium.
Yeah, it's lovely. Home of the National Football Museum now as well. So it's a lovely trip.
And when you're there, did you recognise it as being the oldest continually used football stadium in the world? Did you know that fact?
I did not know that, no.
There you go. You went. And finally, do you have a D for a David Derby player?
David Nish. He played for us when we were champions of England twice in the 70s. I sound like a Forest fan. Why do I keep bringing up all the facts? Yeah, David Nish.
Ah, that's fantastic. Thoroughly enjoyed this podcast, mate. If you want to get in contact, please tweet me. Just tell us if you like the podcast or not, you know, because we've got another 24 of those. If you don't like it, you might as well stop. Let us know anything about it. And next week, A, B, C, D, E. We're on E. There you go. I know the alphabet. We're in E. So if you've got any E's that you think stand out and you'd like us to have a look at them, please let us know. Anyway, that's it for this week. See you all soon. Bye.